From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. When President Donald Trump entered his second term, he promised the largest mass deportation in U.S. history, targeting more than 10 million unauthorized migrants living in the United States. One key tool in ramped-up immigration enforcement efforts is close collaboration with local agencies. It often hinges on agreements with ICE called 287Gs. And in our region, the number of those agreements have risen fivefold since January when President Trump was sworn in. The Mount West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez reports.
The Grito ceremony is a historical reenactment commemorating Mexico's independence from Spain. This Fiestas Patrias, or Patriotic Festival, is taking place in Las Vegas, as it does every September.
People are very enthusiastic about them and are always very happy to celebrate their Mexican origin.
That's Patricia Cortez with the Regional Mexican Consulate.
And what that means to the community.
But elsewhere, events like these have been canceled, organizers citing fears over federal crackdowns on immigration. But increasingly, immigrants are also wary of local law enforcement agencies that have signed 287G agreements with ICE, like the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Sanmira Ramich with the American Civil Liberties Union of Nevada explains it this way.
The 287G agreement is a contract between the federal government and a local entity stating that this local entity will engage in a certain level of immigration enforcement.
A Mountain West News Bureau analysis found Nevada and other agencies in our region, Arizona, Idaho, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, saw significant increases in 287G agreements since President Trump was inaugurated in January. The number surged from 10 agreements in Mountain West states to 54 today, following a trend across the country. Only Colorado bucked that trend. There, state law preventing collaboration with federal officials has stymied 287G agreements and even led to a court battle involving one county sheriff. Some of the agreements train local officers to act as federal deputized agents. Others bring local departments into task forces. And some 287Gs, including the one in Las Vegas, involve ICE holes in jails. Here, the ACLU has filed a lawsuit alleging that the department wrongfully detained Sergio Morales Echevarria, a Cuban immigrant accused of auto theft. The ACLU says local authorities defied a court order.
Nevada District Court judge ordered him to be transported to inpatient treatment.
Instead, he was released into ICE custody.
And what's really interesting about this portion is that this ICE hold, this doesn't come from any judge. It's not coming from a federal judge. It's not coming from any judiciary whatsoever. It's just coming from an ICE official.
The ACLU says Morales Echevarria was denied due process. Days before the case was to be heard in court, the sheriff was at a joint press conference with the FBI. We asked the sheriff about the ACLU case.
I will tell you that the individual that they are suing us over is no longer in custody of the Clark County Detention Center.
The sheriff did not offer any more specifics.
The ICE is picking up people from the Clark County Detention Center today on a daily basis.
He added that the department's agreement with ICE is focused on immigrants in the jail accused of serious felonies and other crimes.
If they're foreign-born and they're arrested for one of those offenses into my jail, we make an ICE notification. Subsequent to an individual being released from the jail, we also make an ICE notification, and a judicial warrant can be served by ICE to hold an individual for up to 48 hours.
In a subsequent statement to us, Metro reiterated that officers do not enforce immigration violations. The Nevada ACLU lawsuit also argues that the department should not be allowed to participate in 287G.
In Nevada, we have a law that prohibits civil arrests, which in this case, these are civil immigration detainees.
That's why the ACLU has taken up the Morales Echevarria case.
And the court would like to begin with a threshold question of standing.
Alex Fugazi, the attorney representing the Las Vegas police, in November told the court that the department's 287G agreement was not in effect when Morales Echevarria was detained. He said while it was signed in June and Morales Echevarria was detained in August, the program was not yet officially credentialed.
What I'm telling you today, Your Honor, is that the credentials have not been given to Metropolitan Police Officer yet.
So Fugazi said the man was detained under other policies.
Qualified foreign-born individuals, individuals who were arrested and charged.
The ACLU accused Fugazi of using legal tactics, splitting hairs.
And then are using that to argue that the court should not get to this point.
In a case that could touch on several laws that govern immigrants in the criminal justice system. Ramage told the judge there's a greater issue at stake.
This is about the liberty interests of hundreds of people that will be held pursuant to this agreement.
The ACLU said it has tracked hundreds of local ICE holds. The police department declined to confirm any numbers for us. Meanwhile, experts like University of Las Vegas immigration professor Michael Kagan are concerned about the fast proliferation of 287G agreements.
Almost all immigration enforcement is just not a criminal matter. It is a civil administrative matter. That's just a fact about American immigration law.
He does not think the feds should tie up local resources.
ICE loves to get local governments to basically lend their resources to the federal government to do the federal government's job. And that's really what the 287G program is. That is a force multiplier, often at the cost to local taxpayers.
President Trump has been very aggressive.
But Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who oversees ICE, said during a recent visit to Las Vegas that local help is exactly what the federal government wants, and there are local officers that want to cooperate.
I think so many law enforcement officers across the country are just grateful that they finally get to do their jobs. We'll continue to do our job and make sure that we're enforcing our law.
We asked if there would be raids in Las Vegas.
Can't speak directly to law enforcement operations that are planned because it jeopardizes the safety of those law enforcement officers. But we will be here. We will continue to be here. It will be sustained, and at times it will surge based on the threats that we see.
As many fear attending cultural events because of stepped-up enforcement, some consulates across the U.S., like the Mexican consulate in Las Vegas, are providing information at detention centers about consular notifications.
To let us know that they're there and so that we can help them in the situation that they are in.
As for Sergio Morales Echevarria, he could not be reached for this story. The ACLU says he was deported to Mexico. Yet the court battle emanating from his situation continues. It is expected to resume in January. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has appropriated $75 billion to arrest and deport, quote, unauthorized immigrants. Some funds will also go toward hiring 10,000 more officers and to fund more federal detention facilities. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Joining us now to talk about her reporting is Yvette Fernandez. Yvette, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You mentioned in the report the ACLU is alleging local law enforcement doesn't have the authority to enter into 287G agreements because of state law. What law are they talking about? Can you explain?
Yes. So there are two different types of local governance. There's Dillon's Rule and Home Rule. Dillon's Rule calls for a more narrow approach to local authority. Essentially, local entities only have the powers expressly granted to them by the state. Now, Home Rule gives local governments and entities greater autonomy. So Nevada functions under Dillon's Rule. And the ACLU's perspective is that Dillon's Rule, therefore, prohibits the local law enforcement agency from entering into these 287G agreements without express permission from the legislature.
Going back to the enhanced immigration enforcement, state lawmakers have taken steps to limit where and how ICE interacts with residents. In particular, I'm thinking about the governor's crime bill, which passed during the recent special session. That measure specifically looks to curtail ICE operations on school grounds. What's going on there, and is that the only piece of legislation that looks to limit immigration enforcement in the state?
You're correct. Lawmakers voted to limit ICE actions on school grounds. That crime bill also makes it illegal for school employees to disclose information about students and their families without a warrant. Also, Senators Rosen and Cortez Masto have introduced a bill to ensure that the Department of Homeland Security allows detained people the ability to notify family members of their location and the ability to access legal representation.
Now, you've kept a close eye on immigration and this administration's promise to conduct the largest deportation effort in the country's history. Through all of this, What has surprised you the most in your reporting?
You know, Paul, we've been following this for a few months now, and in Southern Nevada, it has largely been accepted that we would likely not see any large-scale raids, for example, at hotels and casinos. And the reason we've heard are that these actions are unlikely because these are multinational corporations and because they're so closely tied to the highly regulated gaming industry. But I had an opportunity to speak with the attorney who represented the people who were detained in the raid at the Hyundai plant in Georgia earlier this summer. And I asked him about those similarities. And what he said was very enlightening. He said those are not the reasons that would prohibit raids on the Strip, for example. He said the reason is because these high-profile raids simply require much more work legally to carry out. And he pointed out that ICE apprehends more people in neighborhoods and communities than in these high-profile raids. Paul.
Yvette, we got about 20 seconds left. What are you expecting to see in the coming year?
Well, as you pointed out, this is an effort to deport the most people ever. And while advocates file numerous lawsuits invoking constitutional rights like due process, et cetera, billions of dollars have been allocated toward this effort. So I think that we're going to be seeing more of the same. And the problem is, in talking with other scholars that who have studied previous such efforts, they say that border control and immigration reform continue to be lumped together rather than being addressed as distinct issues.
Yvette Fernandez is KNPR's Mountain West News Bureau reporter. Yvette, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As news years go, 2025 has been a doozy. Nationally, the Trump administration has made headlines nonstop, from the setup of Doge in January to the recent controversy over the bombing of Venezuelan drug runner boats. Nevada and Nevadans have certainly felt the effects of those national events. At the same time, we've had our own particular incidents and issues, from an anticlimactic legislative session to a struggling professional football team. To reflect on the year that was 2025, KNPR's Heidi Kaiser sat down with news leaders from around the state, Vicky Adame of KUNR Public Radio in Reno, April Corbin Gurnis, deputy editor of Nevada Current, and Shannon Miller, editor of the Las Vegas Weekly.
Vicky, April, Shannon, welcome to State of Nevada.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for having us.
It is a delight to have you all here. April Corbin Gurnis, I want to start with you because you were in Carson City reporting for your news outlet, the Nevada Current, for both the regular and special sessions of the 2025 Nevada legislature. I feel like you deserve a medal for that. Would you say those sessions produced the most important news that the Nevada Current covered this year?
You know, probably, even if the biggest story that maybe came out of the legislative session, both the regular and the special, was something that they didn't pass, it's still probably one of the biggest conversations in the state. And that was, of course, the film studio proposal that was to give $1.8 billion of transferable tax credits. That was a bill that failed in both the regular session. They brought it back for the special session, and it failed both times, which if you've covered special sessions over the years, you know most of the time governors don't put things on special sessions unless they're going to pass. So it was a pretty big event in terms of not passing, and it's definitely one of the biggest things.
And there were some things that you were bird-dogging particularly at the session. Did any big stories come out of those issues that you were following?
There's a lot. Obviously, the governor's crime bill was something that did pass in the special session after not getting it to a vote during the regular session. There's a lot in that bill, and there'll be a lot of coverage going forward in 2026 about that bill in particular, with the Strip Corridor Court, the Resorts Court, whatever people are calling it, that is sort of greenlit with that. But that's something that we'll look forward to.
And Vicky Adame, housing was something that came up at the state legislature, of course, and housing costs were also a major factor in the November 2024 general election and continued to be part of America's affordability crisis. Your newsroom at KUNR produced a series of features on housing in Nevada, which listeners may remember hearing on KNPR. Vicky, what were a couple of the main takeaways of that reporting? Is Nevada's housing situation as bad as people seem to feel it is?
You know, it is, because you're looking at, you know, not just your traditional old family with the kids looking for housing, but we also focused on Gen Z, that Gen Z generation who is trying to, you know, start their lives on their own. And what we found is that a lot of them, you know, they tried, you know, they went off to school and they tried to get their own apartment, but they weren't making it. They just couldn't afford rent and the bills and tuition and all those costs, even with a part, you know, working part time. And they ended up having to move back home. So, you know, it leaves them wondering, am I ever going to be able to be out on my own and find a home for myself?
And given how much time your reporters have put into all of that reporting for the housing series, is it something that they're planning to continue covering?
Yeah, we're going to keep an eye on it coming into, you know, the midterm elections, because there's just going to be so many topics I think people are going to be, you know, talking about in both local races and then just, you know, the national races as they come. And I think that's going to be one of those big issues that people are going to weigh on determining who they decide to vote for.
Shannon Miller, a big focus of Las Vegas Weekly, where your editor is entertainment, including on the Strip, and you and the rest of the Weekly staff have been covering the tourism slowdown, among the many other things that you cover. What have been a couple of the most notable aspects of that coverage as you've seen it?
So the tourism slowdown, I believe it was, last time I checked, like every month there's been year over year, it's been down. So that's one thing we know. And that seems to be a pattern. But it's interesting because it's not felt like immediately like a pandemic, for example. There seems to be certain industries that are really feeling it, like the hospitality industry seems to still be standing, but they are showing signs of trouble. Small businesses are also showing signs of trouble. So it's felt in ripple effects throughout the valley, I would say.
And based on what the Weekly is seeing on the ground, because your reporters spend an enormous amount of time out there in the community on this trip, what are they feeling like the outlook is for leisure hospitality in 2026?
Yeah, we actually just had a feature about this, and it was called Does Vegas Need Fixing? And I think the one thing we're already seeing is like free parking, for example. These casinos really trying to appeal to local visitors, trying to get them to come in where maybe international visitation is down. I think that's something we'll be seeing more of and we'll be following.
One way of tracking all of our newsroom's best stories is through awards. The awards that they've won. The Nevada Press Foundation has its print and digital publishing awards. And then, of course, there's the Edward R. Murrow Awards for Broadcast. A question for all three of you. What were your top award winners for you? And Vicki, I'll start with you because I know KUNR garnered several regional Murrow Awards, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we did. We walked away with two first places. One in the hard news category and one in the feature category. So they're kind of the extremes. The feature one was won by Lucia Starbuck. She did a first person mixed with, you know, the camel races up in Virginia City, where she actually rode the camel, you know, first person perspective into that audio story. And then Bert Johnson won in the hard news category for a story looking at documents that were leaked that revealed this political organizer's membership in a secretive right-wing group. Hmm. And it's something that he's, you know, been following. It's kind of like, you know, an interest of his. So it really was, you know, we joked that, oh, it's the extreme from that lighthearted camel race to this really hard-hitting piece. And then we also won a couple of PMJA awards, which is the Public Media Journalists Association, both for, you know, hard news.
And Shannon Miller, you actually won three first place awards in the Nevada Press Foundation's competition this year for your coverage of underserved communities and education, and then also for feature writing about the rising heat. Tell me about that last one. I was intrigued by that.
Yeah. So the climate change one I wrote about, we wanted to kind of talk more about the impacts of climate change beyond just heat. You know, we all know that our ACs are working hard in the summer, and that's something we'll often touch on. The vulnerability of people whose AC goes out. But to think of it from the lens of people who are unhoused, or think about it from the perspective of Renoites who I spoke with, whose insurance had dropped them because wildfires are getting so close to town. So it was really trying to take a bunch of different perspectives of how we consider climate change affecting us and explore that a little bit more. So,
and April, the Nevada Current will be adding several trophies to its display case again this year. Is there one or two that maybe you're especially proud of there?
You know, our reporter Michael Lyle has done a lot of reporting on homelessness. He's won several awards over years about some of that coverage, including this year's series that he wrote about homelessness in the summer and heat. Even this month, he's written a story about homelessness and the impact of non-congregate shelters here in Clark County. So as much as we love the awards, we love that body of work that he's built on that, because as we all know, homelessness has been on the rise here in Nevada and Southern Nevada specifically over the last few years. So we've covered them telling stories of not just of the people who are working there and the nonprofits, but also of the people themselves who, as a reporter, I'm sure everybody here knows, they can be a very difficult population to get to open up to you and to share their stories. And it's a very sensitive topic that Michael, I think, is one of the best in the state at covering.
Certainly. And, you know, I would be remiss here, I mean, if I did not note that our own Mountain West News Bureau reporter, Yvette Fernandez, actually won a National Murrow Award for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for her story that she did about how ending federal radiation exposure compensation affected members of the Navajo Nation. So congratulations again to Yvette for that. Mm-hmm. And beyond those stories that we've already touched on, can each of you give me maybe one story that you would like audiences to read or listen to? I mean, if they only had time for one, we hope they have more. But if they only had time for one, what would you recommend? Shannon, let's start with you.
Well, I think I have a little bit of a saga for you guys, and that's with the consumption lounges, the cannabis consumption lounges this year. So we kind of, I think, got the scoop pretty early on that it was considered the first non-tribal consumption lounge to open. It had opened in February 2024, and about a year later, by April 2025, it had closed. So this lounge was owned by the dispensary Thrive Cannabis Marketplace. And I think it just kind of points to the fact that we're having a really hard time with this. You know, the consumption lounges were supposed to be a solution for tourists to be able to have a place to light up if they want to do that. And they can't do it legally in the casinos or in public. So there's kind of still a question about where they can, if they want to smoke cannabis, they can do that legally. And that's something we'll continue following.
And Vicki, how about you? If you could just call out one outstanding story from KUNR's newsroom, what would it be?
It would be one that one of my interns did this summer on how immigrants are looking north to Canada for the American dream. Mm. These are either asylum seekers or undocumented immigrants. And the reality of finding, quote unquote, the American dream here, it has become more of a nightmare. It's very well sourced, includes numbers from the Canadian bureaus on people who migrate there, experts talking about that. He spoke to one man who got his PhD here at UNR and was faced with the choice of staying here and not working in his field or going up to Canada and working there. And he left for Canada and is making a life for himself there.
April, what's your one big recommendation?
It's a good follow-up to that in terms of the American dream. I and Michael Lyle, we've done a lot of coverages over the years, but including most recently, right after the special session, we wrote about corporate housing and particularly the influx of just corporations who are buying up all the housing units, townhomes, condos, first, you know, family homes, particularly smaller ones, the sort of entry level is what you would call them in a lot of circles. And there was an effort back in 2023 during the regular session, and then in 2025, this year during the regular session, and then again in the special session to rein in the number of homes that these corporations could buy. You know, it's sort of, there's some legal issues there in terms of whether or not people are allowed to do that, and also just sort of free market issues. And there's a lot of issues over there overlapping, obviously. But at the core of it is this idea that so many Nevadans are struggling to find housing, and that, like Vicki said, people are feeling like they can't get the American dream. And this was an effort to try and curb that. And I think when it was happening in the regular session, there wasn't a whole lot of media attention on it because, as reporters, we kind of all knew that the bill wasn't going to go anywhere. It had been vetoed by the governor in 2023. We expected to get vetoed again if it made it to his desk in 25. So it didn't get a lot of attention. But I think it's an issue that people care about. And as Nicole Cannizzaro, the Senate Majority Leader, said when she was talking about the bill, she said, everybody knows somebody who's tried to buy a house and gets priced out. And so we gave that issue and that legislation a deeper dive and a look earlier this month and sort of really looked at it to get that word out there to people to say, hey, there is an effort here, even if it hasn't made it anywhere. And we may see more movement of that and more progress towards finding some solution in the upcoming year.
Yeah, it certainly is something that resonates with our readers and listeners, as I'm sure is true for all of you as well. As the national news landscape continues to change dramatically and respond to various socioeconomic pressures, one response of many newsrooms has been increased collaboration. And another has been newsrooms like ours seeking outside grants and nonprofit funding to support their journalists. A question for any of you who feel like talking about this, how have you seen this play out in your own newsrooms this year?
I'll take a positive spin on it in that as a reporter and somebody who is constantly at events speaking with other reporters, I think there is a sense of less maybe cutthroatness from reporters in terms of things. I mean, I know I've talked to my colleagues, you know, at like The Independent, and I'll see them and I'll see them write about something and I'll go up to them and be like, I'm so glad that you were writing about that. And I think there is this sense that newsroom leaders, a lot of them anyway, understand that, hey, if somebody else in the state is covering an issue really well, that we don't need to cover that also. And maybe so we can pick our topics a little better and focus on that and do things well rather than sort of chasing one another, which I think is a shift, at least that we've done here at the Nevada Current. And I think I've picked up on that in several other publications also.
Shannon, you were wanting to add something.
I think I'd like to comment on just the atmosphere right now. I'm going to be honest, like there's a lot of fear because the First Amendment is at risk, it seems like, in this administration. And so many journalists that I've noticed, you know, locally here in Southern Nevada and across Nevada, I think we respond to that by not backing down and trusting our guts. You know, when we feel like we're being silenced, that's the time to turn up the volume and actually report the truth. And so I think that's kind of our reaction to the atmosphere right now.
And how about the big stories? What are you guys going to be keeping on your radars going into 2026? Vicki, let's start with you here.
Sure. I think for us, I think it's going to be the congressional race up here, the midterm election with Mark Amaday, you know, given, you know, what came through from the government shutdown, from SNAP benefits being cut and everything that we're seeing. We know that, you know, he already has at least one challenger and independent Greg Kidd, and then it appears that there's a Democrat also stepping into the race for that congressional seat, and then obviously just the state races. Mm-hmm. And then just how everything, I guess, trickles down in terms of keeping an eye on the national, are we going to be seeing more ICE raids? Is there going to be more targeted raids here in Northern Nevada? We haven't seen that many, but going into the midterms, one never knows.
And April, how about you over at the Nevada Current?
You know, I think healthcare is going to be a huge issue in 2026. Open enrollment is happening now through Nevada HealthLink, but we know from data that's already been released and that everybody's reported that insurance premiums are skyrocketing right now, both privately and in the public subsidies. There's a lot of arguing happening at the national level, none of which is resolved or seems anywhere close to being resolved. So I think there's a lot of people in the community and healthcare advocates who are predicting the uninsured rate to go skyrocketing again and for people to stop going to the doctor because even if they still have insurance, it's too expensive to get there. And piling that on top of already well-documented shortages of medical professionals, I think we're going to reach a really, you know, dangerous time for healthcare in the next year. And that's something we'll be watching really closely at the Current.
And how about at The Weekly and your sister publication, The Sun, over there, Shannon, what will you guys be following?
Yeah, at The Weekly, you know, we always like to focus on the local, and Las Vegas Museum of Art should be breaking ground next year. So that's going to be something we're watching. And a few other local stories, like, you know, for example, Maryland Parkway's bus rapid transit corridor should be, I think, finished by next year. So we're interested to see how that kind of will be a game changer, how people get around. It's supposed to connect the medical district with the airport, Symphony Park, downtown, and Filipino Town. So that'll be interesting to watch, I think.
That is about all we have time for. You can find links to the stories that we've talked about today on our website at knpr.org. Vicki Adame, April Corbin-Gurnas, and Shannon Miller, thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Washoe people believe the Tahoe Basin, which spans parts of Nevada and California, is where life began. Although it's the spiritual center of the world, they now have limited access to its shores. A grassroots nonprofit aims to change that, healing both land and people. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Kat Fulwider, from our sister station, KUNR Public Radio in Reno, has more.
Waves splash along the shores of Zephyr Cove at Lake Tahoe, or Da'o, as it is known in the Washoe language.
We have stories about every one of these mountains and all these waterways and the way that the lake was before the edge of the lake was all taken up by people.
That is Lisa Grayshield. She's the executive director of the Washoe Warrior Society nonprofit, or Washoe Zuljish Gumtanu. It was formed in 2009 by mostly elders who'd gathered in a prayer ceremony for their youth to follow a good path. Melba Rakow, a Washoe elder and founding member, says the name can be misleading.
The Warrior Society isn't like it really sounds. The Washoe Zuljish Gumtanu meant that it was formed by the soldier or veterans.
Now the nonprofit is at the center of a land back movement. Their goal is to create a land trust within the Tahoe Basin and build a spiritual and cultural gathering center, the Washoe People's House. But it's not just about getting land back, it's about preserving their language and culture, ensuring they're carried on by the next generation, says Grayshield. Board member Art Martinez says the house will also allow them to have a place to gather, pray, and reconnect.
The Washoe people could say this is our place for our sacred ways to occur and to happen and for us to be with the spirits of our ancestors here. Remember, the spirits of the ancestors didn't go anywhere. they're there throughout the basin.
Martinez, a psychologist, says this gathering space is also important to the healing of the people.
It allows then an open place for healers, helpers, elders within the tribe to bring families in need of prayer and so forth in a place that they know is spiritually protected.
He says this is part of a larger international prayer shared with other indigenous peoples to bring healing to the land, the water, and the people. And Grayshield says this includes all people.
When the indigenous people are on the land, engaged in traditional activities, the health of the land will improve. So this is our healing. You know, it's also the healing for the greater Tahoe community.
Grayshield points to the wildfires in the region and says their traditional practice of cultural burning can help mitigate risks posed by these blazes. The next step is finding land, which comes at a high cost in this region. But Grayshield says they're looking to buy or receive land from private landowners in the basin or work with the National Forest Service to co-manage federal land. In 2020, the nonprofit launched a fundraising campaign, and recently, separate landback movements for the Washoe people are gaining traction. Last month, the Wildlife Conservation Board approved a $5.5 million grant to the Washishu Land Trust. This is to support the purchase of over 10,000 acres of traditional Washoe territory northeast of Tahoe. Martinez says although this area is outside of the basin, and this grant is for the tribe's land trust, which is separate from the nonprofit, that it's still great news.
It's a very positive step. We're all moving in the same direction.
Back at Tahoe, Grayshield says they're exploring all options, but have their eye on a parcel on the east shore near Cave Rock, the sacred center of their world. Kat Fulwider, KUNR News, from the shores of Lake Tahoe.
The demand for Native American-created crafts and art has surged in recent years. The nonprofit Indigenous AF just officially announced it will open its gallery doors in the Las Vegas Arts District in the first quarter of next year. This expansion comes after years of fundraising in the Valley. The gallery is expected to have a year-round shop with Native artisans from across the Silver State. Similar stores have also recently popped up in places like Phoenix and Seattle as well. It can be big business, but what about the people who make the items? KNPR's Jimmy Romo recently attended the Las Vegas Paiute's third annual holiday market and toy drive. He has this report.
While throngs pack shopping malls elsewhere, folks inside the Paiute's Health and Wellness Gymnasium sought to buy gifts of a different kind. From hand-sewn skirts to native graphic tees to sterling silver jewelry with locally mined stones in them, the goods on hand displayed crafting that's been passed on from generation to generation. Shanithia Saltwater, a Navajo silversmith from Monument Valley, learned how to make jewelry from her parents.
More because this used to be a hobby thing. I wouldn't be doing it full-time, but now I do it full-time and I'm having a fun time. Shoot, this is the best job I could ever have, to travel around, meet new people, make new friends, so.
Saltwater's mother taught her how to work a polishing machine in her early teen years. After learning to make studs, she started to learn the different techniques in silversmithing and discovered her own aesthetic. Saltwater's pieces often have background stories to the stone used in it, such as the one in her Navajo sterling silver necklace.
But the one I'm wearing on my neck here is a storyteller. All I did is just I hand cut it and then I soldered it together. So it's kind of like a shadow box kind of looking thing. And I have like two turquoise on here, which is Kingman.
To inspire the next pieces, Saltwater watches the next generation and how they wear their jewelry. Both she and Roberto So, a Navajo seamstress, have seen an increase in demand for native designs in the last 5 years. So makes skirts, dresses, and traditional wear in Mesa, Arizona. She didn't have the conventional start into her side gig.
Well, I've never sewed before, ever. It started out during COVID. I was asked to make some face masks. I had an aunt who was selling a sewing machine. And since my own family needed face masks, I decided to learn.
Her mother has a lot of granddaughters, and their adolescent age ceremonies require traditional dress. Enter So and her newfound skill. Word got out among urban natives who began ordering garments especially for graduation, but also for the holidays like Mother's Day. Those buyers include indigenous youth. To So, this is more than just a business.
I mean, people are wanting to know about their culture again, and they want to be dressed up for it. And it's nice to know that I live right there in town, that I'm able to offer traditional outfits if somebody needs it.
The skirts So offers are vibrant in colors, which are symbolic. They're incorporated into the custom jewelry and art of Mark Casal, a Hualapai tribe member from Parker, Arizona. He started selling at craft fairs 2.5 years ago and has learned from the elders about the business and where to source materials. But there are limitations indigenous vendors face, namely events that are largely seasonal, spontaneous, and spread out.
There's not very many places, where we can showcase work, like this, other than, when we have holidays, bazaars. For the majority of the time being, everybody sells at powwows. That's where a lot of people can find, homemade, handmade stuff originally from actual, Native American people, who make those.
Native American businesses make up over 1% of all businesses nationwide, according to the U.S. Census. In Nevada, indigenous business owners make up less than 2% of all businesses in the state, based on data from the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy. Melissa Malera-Moose, an art curator in Northern Nevada, says that being a Native business owner is difficult.
But I think with indigenous businesses and minority businesses, they're so underrepresented for, an array of reasons. So I think keeping that in mind, and also I think the uniqueness of that, we're also so underrepresented as just the population in the country.
However, Nevada is one of the fifth best states for Native American business owners, according to B2B Review. There is a higher than average density of indigenous businesses within its population compared to other states. Malera-Moose believes there's room for improvement.
I think that education of getting started and also dealing with taxes and funding resources and things would be really useful.
A list of Nevada indigenous businesses can be found at KNPR.org. Jimmy Romo, KNPR News.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back to talk about a few of the best holiday options is KNPR senior producer Mike Bravatt, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Let's start strong. What, in your opinion, is the most exciting holiday offering in Nevada?
Duh, it's rafting with Santa.
Really? I mean, isn't that water a little chilly this time of year?
Could be, but not too cold for you, a few friends, and of course, Saint Nick, all floating down the Colorado River. This is a tradition of the Lake Mead Mojave Adventures. It's a 12-mile ride, 3 hours. You're on a motorized raft. You know, this is a pretty smooth ride. It's family-friendly, and it has all the essentials. You've got Christmas songs, hot chocolate, candy canes. There's a free tree ornament, I think, that you get out of it, a free boxed lunch.
But what's Santa doing there?
He is your tour guide. And, you know, he's not like sitting there recounting some blooper reel of his worst chimney tumbles or calling out all the bad kids on the raft. He's going to share all the tea on the Black Canyon and Hoover Dam. So this is going to have a lot of history and science, animal talk, and I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of talk about all the beautiful views that you'll be having on this ride. Now, this starts today, and it goes through Sunday, December 21st, and then once again on Christmas Eve. That's it. I would book ahead.
You know, I think I'm going to stick to the Polar Express. At least that seems, you know, heated. Moving on, as you know, Hanukkah is happening right now. Anything festive going on for the Festival of Lights?
So the eighth night of Hanukkah falls on Sunday. Hanukkah is the Jewish celebration of endurance and freedom. Technically, Hanukkah ends on Monday, but Sunday is the night that ends the week-long lighting of the holiday's iconic symbol of light, the menorah. And there just happens to be one at downtown Summerlin, and that's where the event Light the Menorah takes place. The title says it all. 5 p.m., the final candles will be lit. However, the folks at Jewish Nevada and the Jewish Community Center of Southern Nevada, they're the organizers, and they're kind of sweetening the deal. You've got live entertainment, there's going to be donuts and hot cocoa, there's a raffle, there's going to be some ice skating, some other activities that the whole family can take part in. And this is a big community event for Jewish Las Vegans and for folks who enjoy celebrating the holiday with them. And with the tragedy that occurred in Australia last weekend, I suspect this Hanukkah gathering will have a lot more resonance. Again, that's at downtown Summerlin this Sunday, December 21st. It all begins at 4 p.m.
You had me at donuts and cocoa. Mm-hmm. What Christmas entertainment can listeners look forward to?
Well, there is not one, but two stage productions happening at Majestic Repertory Theater in the Arts District in Las Vegas. The first is called the Blanche DeBrie Emergency Christmas Broadcast. Blanche DeBrie is a burlesque performer of nearly 20 years. She's been described as Phyllis Diller meets Miss Piggy.
Young people out there, trust us on that one.
And when you search YouTube, Phyllis is spelled with a Y. Now back to Blanche. She's famous for doing her abbreviated musical called The Sound of Music in 6 minutes. And 10 years ago, she debuted the Blanche DeBrie Emergency Christmas Broadcast at the Onyx Theater. She brought it back in 2019. And here it is again, now at Majestic through December 21st. Now, someone else described this show as Pee-wee's Playhouse meets It's a Wonderful Life. Taking a look at maybe some of the video and pictures I saw, it also looks like a throwback to all these holiday TV specials from the 70s that had the famous guest performers, and they were doing all cheesy song and dance numbers. Blanche also seems to add a little bit of satire and some social commentary just to kind of mix it up. This is all to say there's a lot of very earnest Christmas entertainment out there, and this is not that.
Now, I can't imagine what the other Christmas show Majestic has on top.
It's not really on the warm and fuzzy side of Christmas. So earlier this year, we interviewed Majestic artistic director Troy Hurd, and if you heard that interview, you know he's really bullish on immersive entertainment. Enter Endclause, an immersive experience for in-between time. And it specifically tells potential ticket buyers that guests are adventurers signing up for a midwinter hunt. Please dress warmly. So this is to say, not a passive experience for onlookers. And it is also not irreverent like Blanche DeBrie. It's a unique take on grief that takes place between Christmas and New Year's. And it's tackling some pretty heavy themes that go beyond just grief. It's also short with multiple performances in the same evening. This plays from December 26th through the 30th at Majestic.
I'm not going to lie, that sounds pretty interesting, but I'm also going to need something warm and fuzzy. And since I'll be celebrating the holidays in Reno, what do you got?
Jingle Bell Rock is what I've got. And this is at the El Dorado Casino Hotel in downtown Reno. It plays through December 28th. Lots of opportunities to see it. And it's, you know, like one of these review style shows. There's going to be singing and dancing, all the Christmas classics. And it was created just for the property showroom. This isn't something you're going to see in Las Vegas or really anywhere else. And it features both Reno talent and performers from London's West End Theater District, specifically Laura Dox and Oliver Ormsson. They're known for playing Anna and Hans in Disney's Frozen the Musical. Now, among that local talent, there's also a Reno's children's choir. I'd say that confirms this is a family show. And if there was ever a Christmas show to take, like, your visiting family, I think this is probably it. So there's your warm and fuzzy, Paul.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.